Hi, I'm Dr. Paula Redmond, a clinical psychologist, and you're listening to the When Work Hurts podcast. On this show, I want to explore the stories behind the statistics of the mental health crisis facing healthcare professionals today, and to provide hope for a way out through compassion, connection, and creativity. Join me as I talk to inspiring clinicians and thought leaders in healthcare about their unique insights and learn how we can support ourselves and each other when work hurts. Health and social care professionals who work with people who've suffered traumatic experiences are themselves at risk of vicarious traumatization. My guest this week is Anne McKechnie, an independent consultant forensic and clinical psychologist who has a wealth of experience in this field. In this episode, she outlines what vicarious traumatization is and how we can recognize and prevent it. I began by asking about her professional background.
I've got to that age where my background takes a good hour, so I'll give you a condensed version. As you said, I'm an independent consultant, forensic and clinical psychologist. Before I retired from the NHS, I was a consultant within a forensic mental health service here in Scotland, so dealt with everything from high secure in prisons to low secure, medium secure people who had committed very serious offences but were also unwell and requiring extra mental health services, specialist mental health services. But I've always had an interest in that interface between offending and trauma, because you can't work with offenders and not understand that actually they do not generally don't come from great, happy, secure childhoods. So that I've always had that interest. In my last post was actually I headed up a criminal justice arm of a trauma service dealing with people who had committed offences, but where there was an awareness that lots of their offending and lots of their risk was related to the fact that they had had experiences of complex trauma, where they had been abused by people upon whom they are dependent. The definition of complex trauma is it's complex because of the nature of the relationship you have with somebody, with the person who perpetrates the offence. You can't get away from them, essentially. Alongside that, I've also been on the parole board for Scotland. I was asked to be involved in Time to be Heard, which was a preliminary exploratory study for how we manage people who've been abused within the care system in Scotland. And I worked in a children's secure care centre for 10 years. So I've had a very varied and very, very enjoyable career. And I'm happy to say at the grand old age of 60, I'm still very much enjoying it. I'm very privileged to be working with the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. I work with Judicial Institute in Scotland. We're trying to do some training through the NHS Education Scotland in helping judges and the legal processes to become more aware of how you can alter your systems to become trauma-informed. But you can't talk about the trauma that's been experienced by our patient group, if you like, without being aware that actually it has an impact indirectly on people who work with those people who have themselves been through trauma. It's not something you can go in, do lightly, just get really engaged in it and then walk away and not be in some way impacted. So the issue about vicarious or secondary traumatization, compassion fatigue, burnout, all of these phenomena is intrinsically linked to the fact that we're hearing and seeing sometimes situations where there has been extreme suffering.
I think that is something that I work a lot with health professionals, so who are very much in a health context. And I think one of the problems I come across is that that bit is just not voiced. People are being exposed to and working with trauma all the time. And that bit about being able to acknowledge and understand the impact of that on workers is not there. And I think if we are lucky enough to work in a trauma-informed service, then that is much more part of the discourse. But I really wanted to kind of unpack that issue of vicarious trauma with you, because I think it's a very overlooked issue for healthcare professionals broadly. And you mentioned a few terms there which I think can overlap, and sometimes we might muddle up together. So we've got vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, burnout, compassion fatigue. It would be great to kind of get your perspective on how we define those things and where they might be different and the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we often tend to think that trauma only refers to the big stuff. So, you know, that in terms of healthcare, we only think that trauma will only refer to people who work in emergency departments or who are doing. I've also done some work in the past with our air ambulance service here in Scotland. And we think it's got to be the big, you know, really bloody trauma, if you like. I mean, my brother's a maxillofacial surgeon, and to him, you know, when I talk about trauma, I can see him thinking, you know, there's no blood and guts, it can't possibly be traumatic. But actually, often what we see is that sort of low, slow, steady grind of distress, which could be everything from your, you know, your certainly emergency departments, but it equally applies to GP practices. It particularly applied during the pandemic, you know, where you saw that continual managing of distress and fear and threat was extremely difficult for people who were in services where you might not obviously consider that they actually have to be trauma-informed. Now, we're very fortunate in Scotland, and in fact, I would urge your listeners to look this up, as NHS Education Scotland have produced, are doing what they call the Trauma Training Framework. And I've been extensively involved in that, and some wonderful people at NES who are rolling this out. And the idea is that we want people across the workforce in Scotland to have a basic understanding about how trauma impacts on the patients that we deal with. Alongside that is the recognition that trauma isn't just outside. You know, trauma happens to people in health and social care settings as well. But the idea being that actually, if you can begin to understand where somebody's coming from, what the presentation might actually be symptomatic of things that you don't know anything about yet, or they might not be willing to ever acknowledge, then it actually gives that element of how can we meet people in that way. And that's been very, very helpful. And I think we're trying to instill that in lots of health and social care staff.
And could you give us a definition of vicarious trauma?
I suppose it's, as it says on the tin, it's vicarious in that it's actually not directly, you're not directly experiencing the trauma. It came, my understanding, it came, a lot of the work came from the States when there was Perlman who first became aware of this concept, and it seemed to be related directly with working with people where there was lots and lots of traumatic behaviour. And I saw it in full technicolour, if you like, when I was working in the secure care setting, where we had young people who were coming in who were distressed, who were angry, who were violent, who were displaying all sorts of risky and challenging behaviours. And the process of managing that, being around that, having that, often that direct threat to self amongst staff, alongside hearing and seeing evidence of what they'd been exposed to in terms of their own trauma, the children's own trauma, the young people's trauma, led to this presentation. And I suppose that we kind of have a sort of continuum from burnout through compassion fatigue, secondary traumatization to vicarious traumatization. And vicarious traumatization is a much more, it changes your worldview. It's linked to that continued and close exposure to the sort of distressing materials we've talked about. So constantly having to read accounts of abuse or view the police are particularly vulnerable to this. So, for example, people who are dealing with internet child pornography, that sort of continual, no break, no change from it. And that sense that you begin to see the world differently. So if you've gone into a profession where, for example, you're caring and you're concerned and you believe fundamentally in human nature, and then a symptom of vicarious traumatization, whereas you become suddenly, you're continually cynical, you think the whole world's out to get them, you don't actually won't let your children be babysat because you're convinced that every single person who wants to babysit is a potential abuser. You see single parents in the park and assume that it's not, don't assume it's a single parent, but you assume it's somebody who's snatched a child and is going to abuse them. It's that really distressing change in how you see the world and a change in your own personal view. So some people are perhaps naturally a bit more cynical than others. my nickname, I've told everybody this, my nickname at when I worked in forensic was Pollyanna. Effing Pollyanna was the full title, but I was known as Pollyanna because I have that kind of view that, you know, it'll all be fine, and you know, everybody's genuinely really a nice person, and we just have to give them the right, you know. So for me, that would be if I was becoming overly cynical. But if somebody started off being cynical and stayed that way, that wouldn't necessarily be evidence of vicarious traumatisation. So it's a fundamental shift in your view of the world, and it's a fixed shift rather than something that might be temporary. Secondary trauma is the next one. That's also linked to constant exposure, but you kind of get symptoms. So it's less about your general view of the world, but actually what you do is you find that, and again, I can think of clinical experiences where I've actually had a particularly heinous offence that I've had to deal with, and I can't stop thinking about it. And you would expect there to be some processing that goes on. You'd expect there to be some reflecting in the immediate aftermath of that experience, but where actually you can't get it out of your head, and you find that you're actually avoiding anything that's a reminder of that. So for me, some of the worst offences I had to work with were ones where there had been infants involved, and where there was one particular offence where there had been neonatal homicide, neonaticide. And the most important thing I ever did in my life was to have my children. So that thought of I couldn't get that image out of my head for a while. Now, there are things to do. So there's a difference between being disturbed for a few days, a week even, and having it something you can't get away from. And also accompanying that with secondary trauma would be finding that you couldn't stop being anxious, or you were overly irritable for a long period, or you were very tearful. So it's a much more clinical presentation, whereas vicarious trauma, traumatization, is much more about that shift in your worldview. So you might not necessarily have that affect impact, but you would have that view. And I think we can think of examples in the healthcare, police, prisons, where actually you can see that, you know, where there people have been around situations for such a long time that actually they begin to think that all offenders are lying, and that, you know, all victims are making up. There's that kind of blanket view of that comes in, which is symptomatic of vicarious traumatisation, whereas secondary trauma is much more that sort of clinical, personal feeling of distress that's associated with it.
Thank you, that's a really helpful distinction. And the other, I suppose the next kind of category in that continuum you mentioned is compassion fatigue. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that really is, again, it's what it says in the tin. It's that reduction in that ability to be empathic. And I think the whole, what's really fascinating is that actually we are naturally empathic. You know, human beings are social animals first and foremost, and we have a desire and a need to connect to others. And I think particularly in the caring professions and health and social care settings, you know, that is what attracts us. That's what draws us in, is that sense that we like to connect with other people. So empathy is natural. But if people are overly exposed again to distressing situations, whether that's the context in which they work or the material that they're working with, the people that they're working with, then it we have a reduced ability or willingness to be empathic. So it's that sense that I don't have any more to give. I'm worn out. I don't have anything else. And it's usually towards one group or one situation. So vicarious traumatization is your worldview. Secondary traumatization is a sort of sense of a sort of clinical feeling of it not being right and encompassing lots of things that you do in your life. Compassion fatigue would be towards one group of people. So I think, at the risk of sounding political for a moment, I think we're seeing a bit of that in terms of people's reactions to refugees. You know, there's a sense that actually, you know, and it's difficult to keep in that place where you feel really sad for a particular group of people. So what you'll see with compassion fatigue is not being interested anymore, just not wanting to know about that group or that situation, rather than encompassing all aspects of your life or society. I mean, I think the thing is as well, to be clear, that these aren't fixed permanent conditions. We all swing in and out of them. And, you know, during the course of a day, you know, I could start off being quite sympathetic towards a situation, quite empathic. And then halfway during the day, usually when I need my lunch, you know, I find that actually I really don't want to hear anymore. I cannot cope with anymore. So I recognise I need to have a bit of a break. And so I can come back. So you kind of, it's often a fluctuating condition. And burnout is a particularly fluctuating condition. So it's not a clinical diagnosis. I think a lot of the time we want to find a sort of clinical name for it. It's on a spectrum. It's a presentation rather than a diagnosis. But it is linked to anxiety. It's linked to low mood, and it can be linked to substance misuse. And it's characterised by emotional exhaustion and cynicism and a bit of sort of interpersonal disconnect. And so everything's on something of a spectrum. So there was a lovely slide that I have used, thanks to a wonderful researcher called Carly Schraver, who's done lots of work, in fact, with compassion fatigue in Australia with judges. She's a doubly qualified clinical psychologist and a lawyer. So she's done some really interesting work. And she talks about this continuum of over-involvement and under-involvement. And I think we can generally plot ourselves on that, which is at the under-involvement level, it's that cynical victim-blaming, displacing onto other issues. So people saying, you know, if it was, this is not about the fact that I'm actually under-involved and I'm worn out and I'm tired and I've got no energy anymore. It's about the fact that the managers are rubbish. And it's about the fact that actually the government doesn't do enough for that. Now, there might be an element to which that's true, but it all becomes all about that. It's never about, actually, maybe I've just had enough. And, you know, I think we can sort of put people into those categories. We might even be so bold as to say that there are certain disciplines, certain professions that go into that category. And certainly in some of the work that I've done with justice systems, we see lots of that sense of, you know, we see that all the time in terms of some management of some rape and sexual assault cases. You know, the person put themselves in that situation. You know, historically, we've had situations where people have said, well, you know, that girl was wearing a mini skirt, therefore she must have been asking to be raped. You know, thankfully, that's becoming a rarer thing. But for me, that would be an indication that somebody was really at the under-involved level of empathy and perhaps was showing signs of vicarious traumatisation. At the other extreme, we've got that over-involved, and I think lots of people who come in from a very compassionate and caring stance often become over-involved in that sense that, you know, it's only me can treat this patient. You know, I've got a special relationship with them. We used to hear this a lot in care settings as well. Oh, all you need is me to come in and I'll fix this person, which is puts a huge level of responsibility on that individual. It also undermines the person that perhaps needs treatment, undermines their ability to get it from elsewhere, and it also undermines the rest of your system. But that's an indication to me of vicarious traumatization, secondary trauma, burnout, all of these issues. And also trying to fix everything. People who come in and think, right, okay, this all needs to be done, and we'll do this. And that's because often they're overwhelmed by the need of that particular situation, that patient that's in front of them, I want to fix everything. But the thing that I see most often is overly excusing other people's behaviours. And this came across a lot in some of the trauma work that I did, where people had terrible histories, really terrible histories. But there has to be an element to which you say, yes, you've had a really difficult time, but actually it's not fair on me to excuse your behaviour all the time. It's not fair of me to do that to you, because ultimately you have to start accepting responsibility. So one of the mantras that I say repeatedly, and I know the inquiry would not be hyping me by saying this, I keep saying special isn't good. If somebody is treated as special, children who are abused are special to their abuser. So special isn't always something that's nice and makes you feel nice and warm and cared about. Often it's about a manipulation. So getting into that sense of overly excusing others' behaviour, other people's behaviours as a result of over-involvement, is often related to that sense they need special treatment. And actually, particularly people who've been abused in childhood and most of our most difficult people to engage and to treat because of their extensive level of mistrust and fear, if we treat them as special, it's repeating lots of those dynamics of the abuse that has been perpetrated.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's something that is always helpful, a kind of question that useful to hold in supervision, you know, thinking about people who do therapeutic kind of work. Are you doing something different for this client than you might do for anyone else? And just noticing why that might be.
And unfortunately, I don't know that lots of the supervision that we are supposed to provide looks at that. I think there's a lot of confusion amongst some professions about the difference between task-centred supervision and reflective supervision. And I think you have to have reflective supervision. I would be so bold as to suggest that's more important than your task-centred. Because most people know what they've got to do. And if they're not doing it, that's often to do with some blockage in how they're feeling and how they're coping, rather than because they don't know that they've got X reports to write or so many notes to complete.
And I think it'll be great to kind of maybe think more about that when we maybe think about how we can prevent and respond to vicarious traumatization. Mm-hmm. But I know you've touched on some of these things, but I wondered if we could just look in a bit more depth into what the signs are of vicarious traumatization, how we might identify that might be going on for ourselves or for others.
I suppose it's probably less important that we label whether it's vicarious or secondary trauma then we actually think about what would be the signs for somebody. So the signs would be finding that, you know, you can't sleep after a certain amount of time, that your sleep is disturbed, that your mood has differed, that you are either working too much or working too little, avoiding work. If you find that your interest in your normal activities and hobbies has gone. I think the people that you're closest to, your loved ones, your colleagues that you're close to, them being able to recognise that something has changed, something has shifted in you. If you're excessively tired, if you find that you're either, you know, I know when I've got to compassion fatigue, burnout kind of level, when actually I'm quite interested in current affairs and when I really don't want to know anymore. When I, you know, make a concerted effort to avoid all the news apps because I just can't cope with anymore. So it's that sense of having an insight and understanding that you are different than you normally are, and that people around you are saying there's something not right. So there's a variety of symptoms, if you like, but I think it's a change in how you feel, how you're managing your emotions, how you're managing your activities, your interests, what your thought processes are. So if you don't have the energy, if you're tired, if you really just can't think straight, these are all things to be on the lookout for, just that shift. And as I say, I would challenge any health professional to not have that at some point. Because it's a risk that we run in the work that we do. Because you can't be going in and giving that empathy. And you know, I'm sure you know Brené Brown's work. She's done a lovely video on empathy. Really, it's really lovely. Again, I would urge your listeners to look that up. And it's that sense of that we want to be beside people. And you know, not it's not about looking down and saying, oh dear, that looks terrible, and why don't you do this and why don't you do that? It's actually saying, you know, this is really tough and I'm going to be with you on this, and I'm going to hold your hand and I'm going to sit beside you and we're going to go through this together. That's what empathy is. But that is so draining. It's so draining. You can't possibly give of yourself so much and then not expect it to have some kind of impact. So we can look out for the signs, but sometimes the situation has gone too far before we recognise it. We should be really working in a very preventative way to make sure that we don't get to that. And that's, I suppose, one of my concerns of what we often do with health services and so on is that we have occupational health and so on that come in, but by the time they come in, it's not too late, but you've got much further to come back from.
I'll come back to that and unpack that idea a bit more. But I also just wanted to check in with you whether you're likely to see those kind of more classic trauma type symptoms of kind of intrusive thoughts, intrusive images, nightmares, the kind of reliving experiences. Is that something you might see as well? And
yes, I think that's often, the other thing is we've got to remember is that people have lives that go on outside work. So that I've seen this more when people have had, for example, for my personal situation, as I say, it was when I could felt some personal resonance because of my having had my children. And that people will see certain points in their lives, you know, the children will be getting to a certain stage, or they might have, you know, other life events going on, bereavements, even nice life events like weddings and so on, where actually you are more vulnerable to that. So you're more vulnerable to that intrusive experience. But, you know, people will say, I couldn't get that out of my head. I found that I was obsessing about it. I wanted to look up more and more on the internet about that particular case. It's just I became really enmeshed in it. So I certainly have seen that, yeah.
Just thinking about some of the people I've worked with where they've been through or worked with, you know, really traumatic clinical stuff, whether that's in health or therapeutic setting, which has been tough. But sometimes it's the organisational response to that is the thing that really sticks with them. So, you know, how an organisation maybe hasn't listened when concerns have been raised or has had a very punitive response. And that is almost, you know, becomes a traumatic experience in itself, that when they needed help, they were punished almost. Or is that something you've seen?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of work with the Forensic School of Forensic Mental Health here in Scotland to do work about what we call it, keeping staff safe. And I think we have to make a distinction between, I mean, after every, say, any major incident, for example, or an incident that requires some kind of recording. And, you know, in forensic settings, there was lots of staff assaults, lots of patients assaulting one another, and everyone had to be recorded. And there's often a need to go in and back in and get the facts, if you like. So what we drew was the distinction between the fact finding, so that you could then determine whether or not errors had been done, and that simple de-stressing. We didn't call it debriefing, we called it de-stressing, because there was a sense that debriefing was a specific phenomenon that was put together, and there's been some mixed evidence, as you'll know, about the validity of debriefing. But what we used to say was people just need to have an opportunity to sit around and have their emotions validated and have their sense of that experience validated, and that everybody has a different way of looking at things. You know, that you could have five people involved in an incident, and, you know, particularly if a psychologist, you'll get 12 different opinions of what goes on. But, you know, you will get this, and you have to be able to validate that. Because if there's a sense from managerial settings that they've got to cover their backs, that they've got to make sure it doesn't happen again, it becomes very much a blame culture. And, you know, I would venture to be so bold as to say that most people who go into a caring profession, if something has gone wrong on their watch, they feel dreadful about it. And I really do feel dreadful about it. So there has to be an acknowledgement that actually this must be really tough for you. And also, I think if people don't, if you have a more compassion-focused, trauma-informed way of working, you're more likely to get better information from people. I mean, we're seeing this in the courts, we're seeing this in legal settings. If you actually have that sense that actually, if we're supportive and we understand what somebody's going through, we're actually probably going to get better information than if we go in with a very high-handed, judgmental, risk-averse way, where we're looking for somebody to blame, where we're not actually saying, you know what, this probably happened as a result of a whole system that was going wrong at that time. Things very rarely happen in isolation. But so you're going to get a better response if you go in with a more compassionate way, but you're also going to protect your staff better. Because at the end of the day, these health and social care settings are dependent on the people that work there. But if staff are off sick, you don't have a service.
And maybe that brings us to thinking about this, the question of how we can prevent vicarious traumatisation in our in healthcare. And I'd like to think about that with you on a kind of individual, what we can do as ourselves, what we might be able to do within teams, and then more broadly on an organisational level. So maybe we can work backwards. Maybe we can start with the organisational bit. What would you say is really important for organisations in order to prevent this?
I think the most important thing is that you have senior management who buy into it.
Okay.
A lot of the time we try to do things from the bottom up, so to speak. We try to do it from the staff who are on the floor. And actually, you need to have senior management buying into it, and you have to have senior management engaging in it. You know, with the organisations I've worked with where they've had the most effective, I would say the most effective processes for preventing vicarious traumatisation, because that's the best thing you can do is to try and prevent it and have systems in to recognise it. But those are systems where actually the senior team are walking the walk as well as talking the talk, and where it's actually demonstrable to others to the rest of the team, they can see senior team going in for their training or their reflective practice. So that's the most important aspect. So you have to have that element of acceptance. This is important, because not only does that then lead to them facilitating it in terms of providing staff to help support the measures, but it also means actually they've got the resources there to provide that backup for when the staff are off the floor to look at the measures that you've brought in. Now, the measures that I've brought in are an element of teaching, psychoeducation. So sitting down and talking to people about how trauma impacts, and talking about what to look out for personally in terms of vicarious and secondary traumatisation. That's what we do. So that's a simple didactic teaching session, lots of information left, lots of stuff left on, you know, on your central drive where people can look up and just check in amongst with themselves. But what we've also set up is reflective practice groups. And that is groups of individuals of a similar level of responsibility and similar job activity. And it really is just as it says on the tin. I think it requires external facilitation, mm-hmm. because, you know, as you know yourself, Paula, reflective practice can very quickly deteriorate into a sort of morning session or a gossip session. Mm-hmm. So it has to be very facilitated by somebody who understands what we mean by reflective practice. And there are some organisations that don't do that naturally. I have to say that, you know, criminal justice backgrounds are not naturally inclined towards reflecting. It's something that we're trained in health and social care to do. It's interestingly enough, it's been introduced to legal training in Australia, which is really, really interesting. And how we've introduced it, and I've explained it to lots of organisations, is that really this is also about you having a chance to learn. Because if you don't, learning is not just about doing, it's doing and thinking about what you've done and thinking how you might have been done it differently or what you've got from it. So it's sold, if you like, as an opportunity to learn and to consider and to contribute to your professional development and your personal development. But it's also an opportunity in a safe place to discuss what might be difficult for you. You know, I've had some people who've been so reluctant to come into a general GRP, group reflective practice, where, you know, literally kicking the door as they come in, you know, like some recalcitrant teenager, and not wanting to do it at all. And what the mantra we have is everybody must attend, but there's no pressure to speak. Because even if you don't want to speak, somebody else might say something that resonates with you. So that might be helpful. But what we also have built in is opportunities for people to seek individual support, if you like, from somebody who's within the organisation. Now, certainly with the organisations I work with, because I'm in with the bricks, they kind of know me, and it's not, you know, people do anything to avoid sitting with a psychologist, don't they? I mean, really, it's, yeah. it's you know, it's a tantamount to torture for lots of people, really. Guaranteed to clear a room or have people left in the room that really you think, actually, I really don't want to start this conversation.
Yeah.
I had a very quick aside. I was at a wedding once years and years ago, and this chap got talking to me. And he said, what do you do for a living then? I said, I'm a clinical psychologist. He said, oh, that's very interesting, very interesting. I could see he was desperate to start talking. I said, before you go any further, I only deal with children and adolescents, and so bedwetting's my specialty. Said, well, actually.
Oh, no.
So, you know, it's best to avoid any of that. But, you know, so I think if a psychologist is around in an organisation and people see that you're on the floor and you're talking and you're having a cup of tea and you're not in some kind of lofty tower somewhere, people are more likely to come along and to talk about things, because I think we have to normalise the fact that work is hard. It really is hard, and I think it's getting harder for health and social care than it ever has been. I think the demands are extraordinary demands. So it's getting harder and harder. So I think to have some sense that there's somebody around whose role is to, and not just to appear at, you know, when you've got attendance management meetings or any of these things that have been brought in, but to actually be there all the time and to say, you know what, let's come in, let's have a chat. And most of the time what I find is people just need a reminder of what they value in their lives, what makes them feel better, you know, what makes them what restores them, what's just restorative, you know, whether that's a walk in the country, whether it's going to the cinema, whether it's having a drink with friends, whatever is a reminder that actually it's okay to do that. And a reminder as well that, I mean, somebody used this analogy years ago, and I use it a lot myself, is that it's a bit like, you know, when oxygen masks fall down in a plane. You're told quite specifically, you put yours on first, because you can't help somebody else if you don't have enough oxygen. And it's the same with our caring profession. We have to recognise, actually, we have to be sound for us to be able to do our job, and the system has to recognise that. So it's a sort of, at the organisational level, it's senior management buy-in, it's teaching, it's mandatory reflective practice, and it's availability of somebody, should somebody want to have that little bit extra time. It's always a balance, because, you know, I think particularly as a clinical psychologist, I can't get into doing the sorts of therapy with people who are ultimately colleagues. It really is just a tweaking and advice giving and a little bit of reminder of what we know about the impact of the work that we do. If it's anything more, then obviously people have to go down a more clinical route. But my experience has been that actually that helps people from going down that slope.
And I guess one of the things you mentioned earlier was about supervision as well. I guess that fits in with that, and that needing to be, again, supported from the top down. Yeah. And a kind of expectation that's part of the work. And I think as psychologists, we're quite like, you can't get away with not having supervision. I love supervision. can't get enough. Yeah. But I guess for other professions that isn't as embedded, and I think that can be,
I think for lots of other professions, I think clinical psychologists gets it right in that supervision is seen as supportive. It's seen as something that facilitates your development as a clinician. And it's very, to be good, it should be very personal. You shouldn't be trying to produce a whole lot of clones who all do the same thing. But I think other professions are not quite so good at that. They think supervision is about, this is how you do, you must do this. This is the only way to do it. And it can feel punitive. It can feel judgmental. It can feel task driven, and it can feel like performance management. And it's not performance management. It really should be, my view is that you need a bit of that as well. And that's where the difference between a manager and a supervisor is quite different. So a manager is much more about what are you doing, how are you doing it, how are you getting on with it. And a supervision is about how are you feeling about that? How is that going? What are you struggling with? What are you feeling really happy with? And a little bit of how are you personally? You know, because I say you can't separate the worker from the individual and all their aspects outside life. So I think supervision is absolutely essential, but I think that it has to be prioritised. So it can't be something that lets slip. So if you've got arrangements for monthly supervision, that has to be kept to it. And if it's not happening, the organisation has to think, what's happening? The supervision arrangements have not been going ahead. Are the demands on the clinician too much? Are the demands on the supervisor too much? Do we not have the facilities, the space to do it? What's going on that this isn't happening? But it's absolutely, absolutely crucial.
And I guess the other thing you mentioned a bit earlier was about kind of post-incident responses. And I guess, you know, thinking about how we might also just normalise that, you know, normalise the fact that after something really horrible happens, people might be upset and, you know, what they need might be different, but making space and validating that in an, again, an embedded kind of organisational way.
Mm-hmm. The forensic service I worked with, we set up a process. And unlike reflective practice, which is generally led by my clinical psychologist, the debrief sessions or de-stressing sessions were run by somebody who was from the same discipline. Because I think that most of the time, the people who were involved in this was in a forensic ward setting, most of the people who were involved in those incidents were nursing staff. And that's one of the realities of, you know, unfortunately being a nursing staff in a forensic setting it was very, very rare that a psychologist or a psychiatrist would be assaulted. Because, you know, certainly in Scotland, as one of my nurses said, if they have a go at you on a ewe lot, they'll be up on their way pretty quickly to the Big Hoose, as the state hospital was called. So it wasn't often that we were involved in it, but nursing staff were. And often, because forensic patients are often aware of the hierarchy, it would be the sort of ancillary staff level that they would have a go at. So what we found it was better was actually for those de-stressing sessions to be facilitated promptly within 36 hours by nursing staff who were trained in understanding the impact of doing this work and understanding what to tell people, how to facilitate a discussion and how to warn people about what signs to look for. Because if you go in quickly and you validate and you support and you understand, then people are far less likely to go off with the thoughts that I've done something really wrong, I'm a terrible nurse, I'm a dreadful clinician, you know, I'm going to be sacked next week. All of these terrible, catastrophic beliefs that we often were left with after something pretty horrible. Apart from the reality that, you know, you might actually have witnessed something that was pretty horrible to witness. If you've witnessed somebody being assaulted, if you yourself have been assaulted. We had one incident in the wards where we had this woman who was really, really difficult, who during a particularly awful assault turned to the female nurse who was looking after her and was foul, accused her of all sorts, absolutely foul, and turned to the male nurse on the other side who was restraining her and said, "You're all right, son, I hope I didn't hurt you." Now, I mean, that splitting, that's going to make the male nurse think, oh gosh, you know, that's terrible. She liked me and she was awful to my colleague. And the female nurse in that situation thinking, oh my God, I must be really terrible because she hates me and she likes him. So all of those kind of reactions and responses need to be heard and validated and understood alongside some information about, right, over the next couple of days, you're going to find you can't stop thinking about it. You're going to find that you probably can't sleep very well. You might be quite anxious about coming onto the ward. You might be quite irritable with your family. These are all the sorts of things to look out for, and these are all perfectly normal. But if after 3 months, because you know yourself, the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder is a 3-month interference in your normal functioning. If after 3 months that's still a problem, and you still are anxious, then we really need to think about this and this is what we need to do. But we know that actually, if you can put in those measures, people are less likely to have some long-term impact on their functioning, whether it's compassion fatigue, vicarious traumatization, full-blown PTSD, far less likely to happen if you have those systems. And my argument is, if you invest in that at the start, you get better stuff. You get a more stable, more secure, more resilient workforce.
And anything, Anne, to add to that in terms of the team level, you know, how we might be able to support the colleagues that we work with closely in terms of preventing?
Yeah, I think having lots of information around, I think that having that sense that you don't necessarily need these particularly special measures, but if we're keeping an eye out on one another, so if we can hear that somebody's had a particularly difficult session, you know, again, in the forensic setting, you know, I was talking about this actually yesterday, that the person who actually did most for us as a clinical team, because we would be involved in pretty horrendous cases, and the person who did most of the supporting was actually our girl on the reception, who once the waiting area was cleared, she would essentially sit there and listen to us offloading. So having that acceptance that actually, you know, it wasn't her job, she just did it naturally, you know, but she was very caring and very compassionate and very concerned. So she would sit and she would say, how did it go today then? And you would have that sense that actually this was important, that actually you needed to leave. Because I think what you need to be able to do in a health and social care setting is to be able to leave it behind. You need to have that sense that actually you have a way of processing or starting the processing in the workplace. Because so often we finish our patients at 5 o'clock, we run out the door, get in the house, start getting everything ready for dinner, you know, kids, all the rest of it, and actually we haven't processed. So it's about processing, and that ability, we know again from studies about how people develop post-traumatic stress disorder and complex post-traumatic stress disorder, is it's the inability of the brain to process those memories and to log them and to file them away. So having these processes that are about reflective practice, simple offloading, having a buddy system at work, all of that is about processing and making sense of what's happened to us so that we can pick ourselves up the next day and go back in again.
And I guess those are things that as individuals we can draw on and make use of those things where they exist. What other things might be helpful for individuals to keep in mind if we're working in these kind of environments? What can we do to kind of help ourselves?
What we've done is we've introduced, I suppose, the other thing is that people need to know that there's a time at which there is no discussion of traumatic things. And I think in busy health and social care settings, we tend to sort of use our lunch hours to talk about difficult cases or to talk about situations that have happened in work. And actually, we need to give people permission to not do that. So in the trauma service I worked in, and I've implemented this in other organisations, we had a sign up which said, give everybody a break, no trauma talk between 12 and 2. So if people were going into this sort of the kitchen area, and again, you know, we need to have areas that are there for staff to be able to sit down and get a break. And the conversation would revolve around everything from Strictly to Bake Off to politics to, you know, what we were doing at the weekend, but a sense that actually we need to have a break. We cannot be immersed in misery the whole day. We can't be immersed in horrible human behaviour and horrible physical conditions all day. We have to have a break. And alongside that, we provided magazines, up-to-date magazines, I would say. I think that I once gave evidence, I'll tell you this very quickly, I once gave evidence in a very remote court in Scotland. And it, long story short, I sat down to wait to be called to give evidence. And there was a magazine sitting there. And I thought, God, Oprah's looking well. That magazine is 14 years old. So, you know, so we have to have stuff. Because again, if you do that, it says to people that you value your staff. So, you know, I go into my dental practice and it's got all the lovely magazines on the table. You know, we're just getting back to that post-COVID, of course, but lovely magazines, which says to me, actually, they value me as a patient. Whereas if you've got old dog-eared copies of, you know, whatever it is, it says that we don't care. So up-to-date magazines. We've also introduced mindfulness colouring cards. We've had jigsaws. We've had books that people have brought in, often just coffee table books. But just a sense, let's make this a really nice space for people to come in and be able to feel that they can de-stress, they can switch off, and they can feel human and encourage, you know, we also have had settings, and this isn't always possible, where you've got, you know, forensic settings, we wouldn't do this, but where you've got, you know, pictures of people's kids up on the wall or, you know, something to just make it feel that little bit more, this is a safe space where people can go and they can wind down. And that's really, really important.
Yeah. It's interesting because we saw a lot of that bubbling up in hospitals during COVID, especially sometimes they were called wobble rooms, kind of a place where you could just go and have a break and be kind of nurtured, and there might be nice snacks and, you know, nice environment. And sadly, I've heard a lot of that now being taken away, you know, now, you know, being used for office space, and people just don't have spaces and time for breaks.
I was just going to say, and yet in some of our private sector organisations, they do that. Now, it might well be a ruse to keep people into work longer. You know, I've heard about big banks who've got hairdressers and dentists and, you know, all sorts on site. But actually, it does make people feel nurtured and cared for. And I think, you know, I think we're at risk, and I can say this as a retired NHS consultant, I think we're at risk of taking for granted the very people who look after us. And I think we're at risk of forgetting that actually this is a vocation, and people are really see it as something to which they are drawn, not for financial gain. Let's be honest, nobody goes into the NHS hoping to make a buck. You know, it's not going to happen. But, you know, you really are drawn in, and you really are want to care for people, and you genuinely, genuinely want to make a difference. But you have to be supported to do that, because we're not a dispensable commodity. As people who work in health and social care, we're not. We have to be recognised as valuable. And let's face it, we spend a lot of money on training health and social care staff. A lot of money. And I'm unfortunately hearing about a lot of people who are leaving the country. Now, we've invested a lot of money in training doctors, nurses, social workers, police, all sorts of really, really valued professions who are leaving because they don't feel valued. Now, is it easier to have to train more and more staff, or is it easier to set up your wobble rooms, to set up a facility to make people feel, actually, we know this is really tough, and we're therefore going to provide support for you so that actually you can do the job that we value you doing?
So there's something about, like, finding spaces to talk as well as spaces maybe not to talk, and just to kind of decompress, be human, have a break from the stuff in work. I'm wondering about what things are helpful for people outside of work, ways of leaving things behind, ways of processing.
Yeah, I think my view is that you have to do something that's not related to your job. So, you know, I have occasionally have flat moments of thinking, oh gosh, I don't do enough, I should go down and volunteer at the local, you know, food bank, but actually I need to do something that is a break from the sort of caring work that I do, if you like, the therapeutic work. So, you know, for me, it's walking, it's having my dog, it's going away for breaks, seeing my family, cooking, you know, reading, gardening. I love gardening. I think it's the only time I'm truly mindful. So I think if I would say to people that actually what you need to do is to do something that's different, but also something that you enjoy. I think we're under a lot of pressure to join gyms and to run up and down hills and all the rest of it. And think, actually, you know, my idea of hell, personally, running up and down a hill. But, you know, so we've got to say that if that's what you enjoy doing, then you do that and you take time and you make time for yourself. and not to feel guilty about that, to actually think, you know what, if you're restoring your sense of what makes you happy and makes you feel content, then you're actually contributing to your job by doing that. It's not self-indulgent. And I think when we come across such a lot of harsh and miserable situations in our work setting, it's easy to think, actually, I feel guilty about the fact that I'm going out for a meal, or I feel guilty about the fact that I've bought myself a new cashmere jumper or whatever it happens to be. Actually, that is part of what keeps you going.
And I guess coming back to that empathy thing, that may be what enables you to stay alongside people.
Yes, you have to get, if you don't have empathy for yourself, you can't have it for somebody else. Because empathy, you don't forget, is actually that connection and that ability. It's facilitated, I think there's all those wonderful studies now that we can do with, you know, imaging and so on. It's facilitated by those tiny mirror movements that we make in our facial expression. And, you know, if we're preoccupied, if we're tired, you know, we're not going to be that engaged with somebody, and we have to be engaged to be empathic. You have to pick up what's going on, and we pick up what's going on by those tiny mirroring that we do in our own faces and our own expressions that tells us what's going on with somebody. If we're preoccupied, if we're tired, if we're, you know, burnt out, if we're just have had enough, we won't do that. And therefore that person will pick up that we're not interested. And one of the things about dealing with people who've been through complex trauma is their go-to position is, I'm worthless, you're going to hurt me. And they will pick up fatigue as disinterest, blaming, and potential threat. So I think, you know, there are certain settings, and we don't know. I mean, even in a sort of emergency department, you don't know what somebody's background is when they come in. You don't know that they haven't been abused by their parents from a very early age. You don't know that. So it's that kind of universal precautions that we talk about, you know, where actually let's just assume that everybody has been through that. And then we can't upset anybody. In the same way that we've created situations where, you know, all houses have got to have disability access, you know, that all buildings have got to be designed for people who might need a wheelchair, you know, so that there's not a sense of feeling different. So I think we have to go in with that sense that anybody we work with might be in that position. And at best, if somebody has been with a clinician who's not empathic, they might think, oh, you know, they have had a bad day and they're not a very good clinician. At worst, they're going to think, that person doesn't like me, they don't care about me, and I'm not going to go back for my cancer treatment. You know, that's the price that we pay by not doing that. So it shouldn't be seen as indulgent. It shouldn't be seen as spoiling yourself. It should be, okay, this is me topping up my reserves because I need them when I go into work.
Yeah. And I guess another aspect of that is particularly for people who have, you know, very cognitively complex work, that if we're holding a lot of stuff, it takes up a lot of headspace and, you know, kind of get in the way of our judgment. And I guess if I was on the operating table, I'd much rather have, you know, a surgeon who had been taking breaks and looking after themselves so that I was in safe hands.
Yes, yes. And I think that's very useful what you say about that cognitive functioning, because I think that, again, as clinicians, we often think, well, you know, I've got half an hour, I should be reading the latest journal. And I should be, you know, attending conferences. And yes, we need to do that. But that shouldn't be at the expense of the other stuff as well.
So, Anna, I'm curious, you've mentioned some of your leisure stuff, but is there anything else that you have in place or that you draw on that kind of supports you, that gets you through the work that you do?
Yeah, I have a supervisor, somebody who's more experienced than I am, who has been retired a good number of years, is a psychotherapist, absolutely marvellous. I couldn't do it without that, because it's my opportunity. And it's not, you know, I sometimes think, oh, what I'm going to talk about, you know, if it's every month to 6 weeks, and sometimes think, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And it's amazing, because it's whatever I want to bring to the table. It's just so restorative. It makes me, you know, really, really value that. And I mean, recently she said to me, you know, you're going to have a holiday. I said, yeah, I'm taking a week. She said, no, you need 3 weeks, Anne. And I came back absolutely inspired and, you know, really, we can't do that every single time. It can only happen about once a year. But, you know, it really is. So that and listening to your supervisor. But I also have peer supervision. So I have a couple of colleagues who I meet with, which is much more about sort of case-centered stuff. But I think that element of thinking, you know, there's no end to that chain of supervision. So those people who are supervising need their own supervisors who need their own. There has to be this endless chain of people who are looking after one another. That is absolutely vital. Because I think there's sometimes a risk of thinking, well, I've been doing this for, you know, 40 odd years, that actually, you know, I don't need this. I know what it's all about. No, you can never say that you know it all. You can never say that you don't need supervision, because it is what keeps you steady and grounded and able to reflect.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please do share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. I'd love to connect with you, so do come and find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. You can also sign up to my mailing list to keep up to date with future episodes and get useful psychology advice and tips straight to your inbox. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks again, and until next time, take good care.